like that, where people know not to turn on their cell phones, where there are no troops on the ground. So their job is to document, and these drones are actually sucking up a huge amount of video. So typically, these combat air patrols are three or four aircraft together, observing the same place from different locations. And they're trying to build a story here. They're trying to say, these are bad people, and this is why. Because despite what sometimes I think we on the left like to think, the armed forces particularly want to make sure that they have a concrete case before they kill somebody or before they accuse somebody of something. So they have to jump through a lot of bureaucratic hoops. They have to create a written case, and they have to have a backup behind it, right? There's a log of everything they say. So there's a tremendous amount of data that's being drawn, and it's been drawn by these pilots and the sensor operators and the intelligence operators. So 99% of their job is staring at the ground and, you know, counting grains of rice in some ways. I mean, that's not actually what they're doing, but that is actually one of the most stressful parts of the job, is watching people, learning about them, and then delivering that. And that, in my mind, is one of the reasons why this has become so stressful.
Prathap Chatterjee, and as you heard at the beginning, perhaps it's up on the Nation's website as well as Tom Dispatch. I guess Tom Dispatch is part of the Nation. Opinions are those of the speakers, not necessarily shared by others. A little couple minutes over. Veterans Intelligence Professionals for Sanity have their comment on the restructuring plan and a link on it up on a website. I think you could just search for Veterans Intelligence Professionals for Sanity. That's Ray McGovern's outfit you might have just heard about. Thanks for listening. It's time for the Labor Hour, kicking it off.
We're Welcome to the World Labor Hour, brought to you by listener-supported community radio station WFT, broadcasting from downtown Champaign, Illinois at 90.1 FM and webcasting live worldwide at WEFT.org. Views and opinions expressed here are those of the speakers and do not necessarily represent those of the station manager, board of director, or Prairie Air Incorporated. Now here's Bob with some underwriting announcements.
Yeah, programming on the World Labor Hour is supported in part by the listeners of WEFT and Decatur attorney Bill Faber. Bill Faber believes that the mission of the law is the safety of the people. Bill Faber proudly supports the World Labor Hour, and the World Labor Hour thanks Bill Faber for renewing his underwriting of this program for another year here at WEFT. Also, the Illinois World Labor Hour is supported in part by the listeners of WEFT and by the AFL-CIO of Champaign County. The AFL-CIO represents the interests of more than 7,000 workers in Champaign County and more than 13 million workers nationwide. Recognizing that strong workers build strong communities, the AFL-CIO is proud to support community radio in East Central Illinois. And the World Labor Hour also thanks the AFL-CIO for renewing their underwriting for another year here at WEFT. The Graduate Employees Organization Union, GEO, at the University of Illinois Urbana-Champaign strives to not only democratically represent graduate employees, but also to give solidarity and support to other unions, organizations, and workers engaged in the struggle for social justice both on and off campus. The GEO is proud to support the World Labor Hour on WEFT Community Radio. And also, this hour of programming is brought to you in part by Central Illinois Jobs with Justice, a coalition of union and community groups working for economic justice and workers' rights. Central Illinois Jobs with Justice holds regular meetings on the third Saturday of every month at 9:30 a.m. at Channing Murray Foundation, 1209 West Oregon in Urbana. For more information, visit www.centraliljwj.org. And back to Dave.
Okay, yes, we're going to be having an interesting program today. Past years, of course, I've always tried to have a program about Irish history, both in America and in Ireland, around St. Patrick's Day. I was kind of motivated to first do that with all the U of I student alternative St. Patrick's Day stuff, you know, making it like, you know, an excuse to get drunk, basically, and be
racist.
Yeah, a lot of times, indeed. Mm-hmm. Yes. And I thought, you know, that people should understand that there's a lot more. You know, I guess, you know, it's not that yes, I'm of Irish heritage, but it's not like I think the Irish people are some kind of superior race by any means. I like to think in terms of the famous Bob Marley quote, that a people that do not know their history are people is like a tree without roots. And I think this is with anybody, and I think everybody here in the United States, their ancestors, whether they're immigrants or African slaves who are brought here, all have histories of struggle in this country against the ruling class and capitalism in general. So this is what I'm trying to basically impart here, is that you know, everybody should try to learn this about their cultural heritage, because it's you'll find it, believe me, if you look for it. And so anyway, we'll start with some news stories first, though. Bob, would you like to start?
Sure. I want to give an update here about the tentative deal reached to end the U.S. refinery strike. The United Steelworkers Union and the oil companies have reached a tentative deal to end the largest U.S. refinery strike in 35 years. The labor group and people familiar with the negotiations said on Thursday that a new agreement for about 30,000 workers would last 4 years, a year longer than previous agreements. The deal still needs to be ratified, so strikes may not end immediately at all refineries, as local union chapters still need to work out pending issues. The lead industry negotiator was Royal Dutch Shell, and they said union members are set to vote on the agreement in coming days. Tesoro told employees in a letter seen by Reuters it was supportive of the agreement and would try to quickly settle local issues to enable our employees to return to work. The tentative contract contains language that addresses worker fatigue, which is tied to accidents, and the use of contractors versus unionized labor. It also safeguards gains made in previous contracts, the union and sources said. They added that annual wage increases would be 2.5% in the first year, 3% in years 2 and 3, and 3.5% in the fourth year. says also that the new agreement calls for an immediate reviewing of staffing and workload assignments for union employees. It also calls for the annual wage increases and maintaining current health benefits. And they include hiring plans to be developed in conjunction with recruitment and training programs. That's from the United Steelworkers International Vice President Tom Conway. So looks like they're finally settling that strike. It affected 6,500 people who had walked off the plant, although only one plant, Tesoro's big plant in Martinez, California, was shut down because of the strike, but it had already been undergoing maintenance when the walkout started.
So. Okay.
But it had affected about 25% of refinery production in the United States and 25% of the workers.
Yeah, I saw some criticism online from various steel workers that said, why in the heck didn't they just shut down every single refinery in the United States that had United Steelworker, you know, that in the strike could have been over in a matter of a day or two, you know?
Yeah, it went on since February 1st, so it had been going on for about 5 weeks or whatnot. Mm-hmm. And it was the largest strike since back in 1980 mm-hmm. at refineries, but largest in 35 years. But anyway, hopefully they're getting more secure jobs, safer jobs for themselves, mm-hmm. and safer for the communities in which these refineries exist. Yeah. Because we've heard about the stories of the explosions and fires at the refineries and the releases of gases to the neighboring communities and stuff mm-hmm. like that. So
now those kids can go back and use those company baseball diamonds, huh, that they were banned from?
I hope so, yeah. I'll get to a little more of that here in a little next story about Bruce Rauner. But
okay.
I think Gus has got another story, too.
Ooh, wow. Well, while it's shaking up over there, it's also shaking up in Madison right now. Madison is boiling hot right now because of the murder of Tony Robinson. Hundreds of people have taken to the streets in protest each day since last Friday, when 19-year-old Tony Robinson was shot and killed by white police officer Matt Kenny in the apartment of a friend. So more demonstrations are planned for Monday, this coming Monday, and the days to come. And students in Madison high schools, which I love, are reportedly planning for a coordinated walkout all the schools in Madison. So that's really powerful. I hope that all of the students are participating in this. The mobilizations began immediately after the shooting, led by members of the Young, Gifted, and Black, the YGB Coalition. And it was formed last fall as part of an emerging Black Lives Matter movement. By 11 p.m. that day, several hundred people were gathered on Williamson Street outside the building where Robinson was killed. And just to give you some background, because we want to make sure that we make the victim a subject of his own story, Robinson had graduated from high school last year in nearby Sun Prairie and was about to begin classes at Madison Area Technical College to study business. His mother, who was recently diagnosed with multiple sclerosis, depended on Tony to help her care for his brothers and sisters. Now, check out what the police did here. Being the nasty, just disgusting, foundationally racist and oppressive system they are, after he was murdered, his mother was not allowed to hold her son's body. The police kept custody, and they kept referring to Tony as evidence. So they took away his humanity, calling him a thing. They called him evidence. And this is something that we're seeing. I mean, like, it's explicit now. There's so many people who are walking around saying that this is, the racial relations have gotten better and maybe implicit racism. I mean, we're going back to straight up old school 18th century racism here. Mm-hmm. Calling a person who has just been murdered, unarmed, evidence, a thing. That's what's happening right now. And just to give you just one more tidbit on this, they've already talked to a few eyewitnesses, and the police version of what happened is extremely contradictory to the eyewitnesses' claims, because there already was some issues about whether he was unarmed or not. The police just admitted that he was unarmed. So again, I don't understand this idea that there are some good police and there are some bad police. Immediately after this happened, there should have been some type of police union to come out and issue a statement saying we do not support this type of behavior, because that way we're going to start building relationships with the good police. If the good police will actually step up and say it's not all of us, we are condemning the behaviors of murderous cops. But yet throughout history, that has never happened except in very small spurts. So until that actually happens, they can miss me with that whole they're good police thing, because this is disgusting behavior. Nobody's speaking out against this that's on the police side. It's ridiculous.
Yeah, indeed. And there's some history to this in the sense that, you know, the police were originally set up to control working people, you know, not just petty crime, but to basically prevent them from organizing against the ruling class.
Yeah.
And I think, you know, we've come in full circle here. You know, it seems like the police now are being trained more like occupiers of an occupied country, and acting like the people are the enemy. You know, I think this is part of the problem. I mean, is that this is part of their training. But you know, I don't think racism is a part of their training.
It's a part of this country.
It still seems like it seems like it's encouraging racist cops, though.
No, it's because the system itself is racist. I mean, what were the first policemen in history in America? They were slave patrollers.
The slave patrollers
were the first. Their job was to control the proletariat, the slave workers, and to make sure that they do not rebel. They come up with all these other things that they did. That's what they're doing now. It's the exact same thing, because it's a foundational aspect. Until we break the foundation and change the way that people are, that the police are organized and the police are trained, the police are paid, everything, the whole system, this is going to continue. You can't switch out a couple of cops and think that it's going to stop. We have to break open the system, the foundation, and change, restructure it.
Indeed.
This is ridiculous.
Oh, God, it's disgusting. Okay, Bob, what do we got about your buddy in Springfield?
A couple of things came out this week. Rauner freezes park construction grants. Says in what state park district officials call an unprecedented decision, Governor Bruce Rauner Wednesday indefinitely suspended state grants for park district construction projects. The move affects construction projects throughout the state, ranging from planned upgrades to the Miners Memorial Park in Cesar to improvements at Nelson Park in Decatur, projects all around the state as well, Congerville, Mount Pulaski, Streeter. Says from a memo from the Illinois Association of Park Districts, it says these suspensions even cover construction projects that are currently in progress. It says with construction season upon us, this decision could not come at a worse time. The suspension not only threatens jobs that are helping to grow Illinois economy, it creates exposure to local taxpayer for existing contractual obligations and projects costs. You know, this is what we were talking about earlier. You know, the company not letting the kids play at the ball fields out there. Why is Rauner coming down on the kids around the state of Illinois, stopping construction and stopping jobs that were already in progress? He's supposedly trying to help grow our economy, you know. Anyway, it continues the public rift between Mayor Rahm Emanuel and his pal Governor Bruce Rauner got wider on Thursday, thanks to Rauner's decision to immediately freeze $28 million in state grants for 27 park improvement projects in Chicago. And then he's been going around the state here with his newest proposal this week. Wednesday, he was evidently up in Rantoul.
Really?
And and mayors from several area communities expressed their concerns to Governor Bruce Rauner over Rauner's proposal that he would reduce the amount of what they refer to as local government distributive fund, the LGDF, money their communities would receive. Mayors met with Rauner for about an hour at the Rantoul Municipal Building Wednesday after the governor toured Coombe Laboratories in the village's industrial park. Rantoul Mayor Chuck Smith said Rauner spent much of his time explaining his plans to turn around the state's finances and said he needed the help of local governments, which might have to receive less money. Under Rauner's proposal, it would cut LGDF money from 8% to 4%. Rantoul would lose about $618,000 a year.
Wow, that hit a community that size pretty hard.
He's doing it to communities all throughout the state. Mm-hmm. So now, mayors from, who was there? Champaign, Urbana, Mahomet, Paxton, Savoy, Urbana, Danville, all of them, also representatives from Vermilion County, all were up at this meeting with up in Rantoul. The week before that, he was making the same proposal up in Elgin. Mm-hmm. Hundreds of union protesters were up there protesting outside the building, and mayors up there aren't too thrilled about this either. These communities may lose as much as $1 million that they had coming into their communities, and he seems to say he's going to be increasing jobs. And if he's cutting all of this money going to all of these communities, all that's going to happen is, you know, things are going to fall apart in these communities and hundreds of jobs will be lost around the state. So,
does either of you know if there's under the Illinois Constitution, the ability to have a recall election on the governor? Because boy, this would be a good time to start one. It seems like
I've heard people speaking about that in the conversation. I think there is.
I mean, he seems like he's making a lot of people.
Weren't they talking about recalling Blagojevich for a while?
You know, that's right. I remember talking about that. Well, I mean, maybe we can look into that.
Maybe somebody can look into that.
Okay, I want to do some public service announcements real quick here, and then we can get into the kind of the heart of our show here. Let's see here. Okay, so remember the Bowles-Simpson Social Security Medicare cutting plan? It was the proposal which attempted to cut Social Security and Medicare while also cutting taxes for wealthy Americans. And guess what? Members of Congress are trying to bring it back right now. And this is what we've been warning you about. And telephone your representatives in Washington, D.C. and your U.S. senators that the Bowles-Simpson plan should stay dead because our Social Security system needs to be expanded, not cut. The truth is that Social Security has a $2.8 trillion surplus and can pay out every benefit owed to every eligible American for the next 18 years and approximately 80% of benefits owed after that, just based on its current funding. And all we need to do to make it more extended even farther in the future is ask the very wealthy to start paying their fair share so we can extend the lifespan of Social Security. So call your congressman, both you and the senators from your state, and let them know that you will refuse to vote for any elected official incumbent, regardless if they are Republican or Democrat, if they vote to cut Social Security or Medicare. And let's see, Sunday from 4 to 5 p.m. is Labor's Worldview TV on Comcast Channel 6 and urbanapublictelevision.org. This Sunday is a rerun of a program we did 5 years ago called the St. Patrick's Day program on Irish labor struggle. And it's a couple of it's discussion with myself and Jim Iman, and also segments of the films Michael Collins and The Wind That Shakes the Barley. And so tune into that tomorrow from 4 to 5. And today at 1 p.m. at the Champaign Library Room C, Rich Whitney, the past gubernatorial candidate for the Green Party, will be having a press conference. How to solve the Illinois budget crisis, and that's today 1 p.m. in Champaign Library Room C. Okay, so you know, we want to talk a little about you know, a little bit of Irish history and stuff, and I just happened to stumble across this on the internet. It's from posted by reunionblackfamily.org, and the title of it is "The Irish Slaves: What They Will Never Ever Tell You in History Class or Anywhere Else," and this intrigued me, and I caught it. It's basically about an article that goes pretty extensively about white and black slaves in the sugar plantations of Barbados, and this was pretty common, and that even in the American colonies here. So the first slaves imported into the American colonies were 100 white Irish children that arrived during Easter of 1619, 4 months before the arrival of the first shipment of African slaves. And it says mainstream histories refer to these laborers as indentured servants, not slaves, because many agreed to work for a set period of time in exchange for land and rights. Yet in reality, indenturement was enslavement, since slavery applies to any person who is bought and sold, chained and abused, rather for a decade or a lifetime. And they said too that a lot of people that tried to enforce their indentured contracts were refused, and they basically became slaves for life. And what's really interesting here is there's a drawing here that shows it shows some African American people and some white European American children, and it says here the title of it is "Emancipated Slaves, White and Colored in New Orleans by Order of Major General Banks." Check that out, Gus. I mean, that blew my mind. And I had no idea. You know, I knew about the indentured servitude, but I didn't know that it had continued up until the Civil War. So evidently that was in 18... When did they liberate New Orleans? Was it 1863 or later?
It was early 60s. I think it may have been 62. But yeah, okay. There was a lot of issues going on at the time where because of the rebellions and what was happening in Peter Wood's book, Black Majority, talks about this a lot. But there was an issue where the rebellions that were happening in America on the slave plantations and the farms, there was day to day resistance and there were mass rebellions. There were maroon communities being set up, and also the stuff happening in Jamaica and the sugar colonies in the Latin America area. A lot of wind was going around amongst the white planters and the government that, you know, we may have some issues here with our labor, and we need to divide our plantations and farms up. So let's start bringing in more, let's start advertising more overseas to Europe and bring over more poor or working class people and promise them indentured servitude. So you had a mass influx of Irish and other Western European poor people coming over towards the mid 1800s, because so they were trying to actually stop what was going on and hope hoping that, this would not turn into a Haitian revolution situation, because there was so much sparking going on, and that they knew that word was traveling about the rebellions in the sugar colonies and coming to America. So there was a lot of bringing in a lot more Europeans. And what they found out was that they were not as adept at the production of the work because of their foundation in Europe. They weren't able, you know, they didn't do the same type of work as the Africans. So,
and the Africans came from a tropical climate too.
Exactly.
So they were more adapted to that kind of climate, at least.
And they were also trying to organize with them, because once they got there, they were like, yeah, you know, we should do things. So of course that's when they created the psychological wage, and they forced the whites to see themselves as racialized labor, and they started giving them more things to make them feel like they were better than the slaves. So that's what led to one of the earliest breaks between
them. It says in here, and you can maybe give this some context, it says in 1676 there was a huge slave rebellion in Virginia. Black and white slaves burned Jamestown to the ground. Rebellion?
Bacon's
rebellion. Yes. Okay. I thought that was the case. I wanted to clarify with you, the historian, on that.
Yeah, that was one of the key moments in history where you actually had a chance for a workers' revolution. Mm-hmm. Like the workers, both black and white, had gotten together, and they had, like you said, burned the colony to the ground. Mm-hmm. And so the government got together and said, "Listen, we have to actually start racializing our labor,
divide and conquer."
Yeah, and that was when a lot of the racial policies came about, and they started creating laws that restricted African Americans from doing things, because by doing that, you're showing the white workers that I do have something better than them, and I don't have to worry about competition. Then you started seeing more lower class whites who had very little money on the farms in the South going and actually being brought onto plantation to be overseers. So they got to take out their anger and frustration of their labor situation on the African Americans, because they couldn't take them out on the planters. So all that started because of Bacon's Rebellion, because they legitimately saw, this is an issue. The workers are going to burn this country or this colony to the ground. So we got to stop this. So that's one of the biggest disruptions in American history was Bacon's Rebellion.
Thank you for that historical context there.
Yeah.
Yeah, and I'm going to play some, this is going to be the first segment of some Irish music. This is called 1803 Derry, and it's about, there was a huge rebellion in Ireland in 1801 led by a guy named Theobald Wolfetone, and it was a time when he actually was able to unite both Protestant and Catholics against the British, and unfortunately it failed. And what they did was, the people that were fighting in this rebellion that were captured alive, they put them in chains and put them on ships and sent them to Australia. So there's kind of a commonality here. We've heard this story before. So I'm going to play a segment of that here real quick, and you're listening to World Labor Hour, and we'll be right back. Stay tuned.
Sailed out to sea, off from the sweet town of Derry. For Australia bound, if we didn't all drown, and the marks of our fetters we carry. In rusty iron chains, we sighed for our wings, our poor wives we left in sorrow. As the mainsails unfurled, oh, the curses we hurled on the English and thoughts of tomorrow. Oh, I wish I was back home in Derry. Oh, I wish I was back home in Derry. I curse them to hell as our bow was to swell. Our ship danced like a moth in the firelight. White horses rode high as the devil passed by, taking souls to Hades by twilight. 3 weeks out to sea, we were now 43, our comrades we buried each morning. And in our own slime we were lost in a time, an endless night without dawning. Oh, I wish I was back home in Derry. I wish I was back home in Derry.
live out his life in slavery. Well, I claim it is a raw, and the gun makes the law. Neither wind nor rain take the bravery. 20 years have gone by since I ended my life. My comrades' ghosts are behind me. Well, I'm rebel like him, and I die just the same. On the cold winds of night you will find me. Oh, I wish I was back home in Derry. I wish I was back home.
Okay, you're listening to the World Labor Hour, and that was a band called Bluestack, and it was a song called 1803 Derry, and we're going to be playing some similar songs about Irish music here, basically labor and revolutionary music during the program. But, you know, it's I want to go turn now to a local labor activist and historian, James Barrett, about his book called The Irish Way. And he's written other books prior to this. He wrote a really good one about William Z. Foster, who was a labor organizer and member of the Communist Party back in the 20s and 30s. He's worked one on work and community in the jungle, Chicago's packing house workers, 1894 to 1922. And the one about William Z. Foster is William Z. Foster and the Tragedy of American Radicalism. And this is real interesting because, you know, he talks about the Irish in America and how they came here like other immigrants. I just kind of wanted to read just a little segment here. And a lot of this is it includes, you know, all sorts of cities, but it has a kind of a tendency to talk about Chicago. Of course, that's where James Barrett's from originally. But anyway, it's on he's talking about how, you know, over the past year, a new stockyards labor council had swept through the crowded wooden tenements and greasy slaughterhouses in Packingtown. This is in 1918, a slum mentioned in Upton Sinclair's muckraking 1906 novel, The Jungle. And it drew thousands of immigrant laborers as well as recent African-American migrants. The impoverished laborers, badly divided along ethnic and racial lines, had recently confronted the Big Five Packers, winning an unlikely victory, substantial wage increases in the eight-hour day. And on this Easter afternoon, John Fitzpatrick, the architect of this new movement, rose to speak amid the church steeples and smokestacks of Packingtown. Born in County Westmeath, he arrived on Chicago's South Side, went to work in the stockyards at the age of 12. And Fitzpatrick soon immersed himself in the city's vibrant union movement. And anyway, in 1902, a group of reformers persuaded him to run for president of the Chicago Federation of Labor, a position he'd hold until his death in 1946. And anyway, it talks about a little bit about this Fitzpatrick, and I guess you know, during this meatpacking strike, that the employers, of course, you know, divided the workers along you know, racial and ethnic lines,
right.
And it was interesting. You read, Gus, maybe you can help me out here. The one who wrote a lot about labor history in America, Fauner.
Yeah, Eric. Both he and his brother Eric and Philip Fauner. Yeah.
Okay, he talks about you know, the strike, the meatpacking strike, and he talks about Fauner does about how the African American community was divided of the strike. Particularly the churches, and he said some of the churches were pro union and would help out, you know, with the striking workers, but the other half, which was interesting, along with George Washington Carver, actually helped recruit scabs, replacement workers in the South, brought them up to Chicago, and of course weren't telling them that they were coming into a strike situation.
Exactly. Yeah.
And they would house them in a lot of the YMCA and the churches and stuff.
Yep.
And so, you know, that was one problem. And of course, this really caused a lot of hatred and anger. But what was interesting is his strike was that it was actually able to unite across racial and ethnic lines, and they did win a strike. Unfortunately, the next year, 1919, what happens?
Yeah, the riots.
Race riot, you know.
The Chicago and with the red summer. So
what's interesting about this is, and you know, of course, James Barrett touches on this, is about how it seems like you know, the ruling class in this country are so good about dividing and conquering people. Mm-hmm. And there's moments when there is unity that goes, you know, basically is able to counter that, you know. And then it's just so fragile. I mean, it seems like it's just so easy for them, it seems, at times to, you know, they'll lose one and they'll come right back and be able to, you know, use the same old tricks to divide people.
I mean, it's kind of like what Karl Marx was talking about when he talked about the means of production shifting because of the resistance to it. You know, the whole thing with the revolutionary working class struggle, and when you have that unity that actually builds, you know, the capitalism or the system itself has to restructure itself or else it'll collapse. So it would change because it has that dialectical relationship to resistance. So it has to change it to survive. You know, so yeah, I think that it comes from all of it centers on the fact that you have that solidarity, that revolutionary working class struggle against that type of system and that type of oppression. So that's where it really comes from. Yeah.
Yeah, this is interesting too. I guess there's a little article, I mean, a little part of this book too, later in the chapter. And he's got this chapter is called The Workplace in his book. And it says here, when sociologist E. Franklin Frazier interviewed New York's black longshoreman for a 1921 study, I take it this is on the East Coast, they reported that Italian longshoremen showed less racial antipathy, more so, you know, basically they had less racial problems than the Irish did, more likely, to accept them on the docks. And he said the other observation, though, was more ominous, that the Italians seemed to be, over time, assimilating the prejudices of other white workers in order to, apparently, to ensure their increased standing. I mean, see how this insidious thing works?
I mean,
the recent immigrants have no racism, but yet when they're here for a while and they're like on the bottom of the pecking order, they start to think, well, you know, they start accepting these racist attitudes in order to kind of...
Yeah, I mean, all of it goes back. I mean, you can go back even to the New York riots of 1862 that were supposed to be about the draft, but it was actually about black dock workers taking jobs from the Irish in New York City.
Okay.
So a lot of people think that was strictly about the draft and the Conscription Act, but it was actually sparked because of black workers were actually getting jobs in New York City that the Irish unions felt that they did not deserve. And all of this comes from the fact that we have to compete for racialized labor in this country because of the way the system is set up. Mm-hmm. So the Irish and the Italians who are adopting these types of racialized ideas, they're trying to survive in an oppressive system, and they're using that psychological wage to get there to have that type of situation where they can survive. Mm-hmm. And it's unfortunate that it's like that. So it's like a lesser to evil type situation, because do I starve to death or do I die, or because my skin is white I'm able to accommodate myself to this system. Mm-hmm. And that's because the system itself is faulty and oppressive. So yeah, that's these things would not happen, and these racial ideas would not exist if not for capitalism being so oppressive and dominating throughout this country.
Yeah, that New York riot was, of course, portrayed in that film.
Gangs of New York.
Gangs of New York. Thank you, yep. Martin Scorsese. But of course, they didn't even mention that in there. Of course.
Oh no.
But I think one thing about that film that I think is done real well, though, is showing just the amount of poverty and desperateness
yes.
at that time. Oh my God! Yeah. I mean, you know, I think it's funny when I hear some people say, "Oh, the gang problem is so bad. These gangs this day and age." I said, "Really?"
Exactly.
Go back and do some historical reading. I mean, you know, there was one, riot in New York City on the West Side, which is the traditional Irish neighborhood on the docks. Mm-hmm. Were they? It was a gang. I can't remember what they were called at that time. They had different
names. Was it during this time? 1860s?
It was later on. It was like about 1898, 1905. And they had whole neighborhood had a pitched battle with the New York police for 5 days. Wow. Day and night. There was 100 some people killed. And I guess when the police started to get the upper hand, they brought out the women's auxiliaries who don't have images of women with mops and brooms. They came out with what was called ice spears that they'd used to, stab blocks of ice. They came out with axes and hatchets, and you know, then they come out and they tear up stones in the street to throw at the police. So I mean, you talk about gang problems. I mean, let's talk a little about some history here.
Wow,
gangs, what they, and a lot of times, you know what? It seems like anymore they call it a gang any group of three or more young males, usually African American or Latino. Well, they're a gang.
Yeah, these laws are ridiculous in this country. I mean, even the most goofy ones, they call a menage a trois, three people sitting on the couch with their shoes off. So I mean,
I've never heard that. That's funny.
Yeah, that's actually in the law books in this country. So I mean, it's some of the most asinine, ridiculous stuff that creates this country's supreme laws are Yeah.
Man.
So, yeah.
So, anyway, you know, and James Baer talks a little about, you know, the Irish immigrants and stuff. And one thing, of course, that's, you know, a lot of people know about in Irish American history is the thing about the Molly Maguires, basically right. The miners, Irish miners in eastern Pennsylvania, kind of north of Philadelphia, I think about an hour or so by car, and they had a really abusive, you know, bosses and stuff. And so what they did was they organized secret societies and retaliated against the bosses and stuff. And so I'm going to play a song about that next here. It's actually, what's interesting, this song, is from a CD by a man named Cy Kahn, who's a Jewish man who is actually a community organizer. And it's funny because we actually had him call into the Labor Hour.
We did a couple years ago.
Yeah. And I guess he went down to Mississippi in 1964 when he was 17 years old.
Wow.
You know, even though it was against the wishes of his parents because they were naturally concerned, considering all the violence that went on down there. But I guess he's a community organizer. He's also a musician and songwriter and
author. Doesn't he have four or five books?
He has four or five books too about community organizing. So it's just funny that you know, I mentioned to him, and you know, about how, wow, I said, this one song you did about the Molly Maguires, it's like, wow, it's really powerful. You know it sounds like you have you know, that you actually had your Irish heritage. You heard this story personally from your grandparents or great grandparents. And he says, well, you know, that's where he made the point about, you know, all of us of our various ethnic heritages, we all have common you know, histories of struggle, you know.
Right.
So he said this was easy for me to relate to this and write this song. So I'm gonna play that real quick here, and then we're going to be right back. You're listening to World Labor, our Arnless Supported Community Radio Station, WFT in Champaign. Stay tuned.
Down in the darkness, down at the breaker, close on the midnight hour, steadily working, quietly leaving, trailing a thin line of powder. The little Schuylkill Valley tan is all lit up tonight by flames that lick like tongues from the breaker fire. The tight-lipped coal and iron police won't get much sleep tonight, looking for the sons of Molly Maguire. Out in the tavern, banded together, strong men are hiding their sorrow. Over at Pottstown, at the prison, 10 men are hanging tomorrow. I only tried to organize the men I worked among, but I'm hanging in the morning. Will you miss me? And Monday early, so they say, the mines will open back. The coal and iron police are drinking whiskey.
Hello, WFT.
Jim Iman.
Hi, Jim.
It occurs to me that there's a it's very interesting about the story about the Black Irish who escaped from the Spanish. And of course, Ireland was had open arms for them, and or if they even got close enough, you know, they would jump ship and make it to Ireland. And the other one, and it was probably nearly 1,000 of them in the course of the wars. And the other thing is the origin of the term hooligan actually comes from the Houlihan brothers.
Oh, yeah. Okay.
Who had a gang in London.
Uh-huh.
And when Parnell was unseated because of that sex scandal, you know, they started rioting in the streets.
Okay.
Parnell. So I just thought that was interesting. And I'm looking forward to being on the show next week.
Okay.
And taking up the question of vanguardism with guns.
Oh, yeah.
Okay. All right. Well, Jim, thanks for calling in and sharing that with us. Really interesting. And we look forward to next week, of course.
Okay, bye.
Goodbye. Okay, that was Jim Iman. And anyway, we also have the phone line open that James Barrett, the author of Irish Way, may call in. He said he's going to try, but we're not going to, you know, expect it because there is a family matter that he, urgent family matter he has to take care of. But anyway, I want to talk a little about another person, and this is kind of a sort of a hybrid between Ireland and the Irish Americans, and this is a guy named James Connolly. And the reason I say that is because James Connolly was born actually in Scotland of Irish immigrants and was in the British Army for a while and then basically deserted and then went to Ireland with some relatives and stuff. And then he immigrated to the United States in 1902 and after a few years working here, I'm sorry, 1903, and a few years working here actually became an organizer for the IWW, the Industrial Workers of the World. And he lived here until 1912 and went back to Ireland when there was actually a lot of labor strife going on. And he participated in the 1913 Dublin General Strike with James Larkin of the Irish Transport Workers Union. But the reason I want to mention him is because, you know, a lot of people... this is where it gets kind of interesting. I mean, then we get into kind of Irish politics here, is that when the Irish were fighting, basically trying to get independence from Britain, unfortunately, a large current were like Irish nationalists who basically said, you know, that it was an Irish-British problem, you know, and that you should hate all British and whatever. And Connolly writes in Labour and Irish History about how it's not that. It's a working-class fight, a worldwide working-class fight. Mm-hmm. He writes extensively about, you know, he documents a lot of the problems that the British working class were having, and said that, you know, in some ways they had it worse than the Irish working class. He has a famous quote about how, what good will it do if we lower a British flag and raise an Irish flag if we have the same system of the landlords, the bankers, and the other capitalists in charge? What have we gained? You know, nothing, basically, you know. And so this is what's, you know, he's always portrayed as an Irish nationalist leader. He was killed in the 1916 Easter Uprising. They found him such a threat that he was mortally wounded, and they still carry him out to the prison yard on a stretcher, tied him to a chair, and executed him. Wow. You know, but you know, it's interesting. A lot of his he was also kind of controversial within the in the left a little bit, in the sense that he had a kind of a very let's see, where should I start here? Well, actually, Connolly, it says here, considered himself a socialist, but always advocated revolutionary syndicalism, which he called industrial unionism, and advocated the political system of a cooperative commonwealth, even though he was also considered himself, very much influenced by Karl Marx and his writings. But anyway, he said in 1908, there was a split in the IWW that occurred between the Marxist Daniel de Leon and the anarcho-syndicalists. Yep. Wing, and Connolly sided with the anarcho-syndicalists, although de Leon was a major influence on Connolly, and he said that basically the part of that was that he was kind of repulsed over time by de Leon's sectarianism. But he goes on to say that their biggest disagreement was de Leon argued for a revolution that involved seizing control of the state by politicians mm-hmm. through the election of a socialist party, and that the role of industrial unions would be to support the party, where Connolly advocated instead for a revolution that gives immediate power to new forms of social organization, a revolution led by the workers themselves without being subordinate to any party. So Connolly's got some interesting quotes that I think are kind of important today. One of them, of course, is where he mentions about how, what good does it do democracy entering government without the power of the industrial union behind it, which is basically organized working class and the unions, it would be like the a victim entering the stomach of a snake, basically. And one of my favorite quotes from him, of course, is he says that the fighting spirit is much more important than a perfect organization, because he says the perfect organization, by its very nature, can tend to limit or you know, kind of destroy the fighting spirit. So he's basically saying that the fighting spirit is important for people to be able to organize, even though an organization is important as well. So, I mean, his writings are really interesting. And like I said, what I found most interesting in the fact was that I always thought he was an Irish nationalist, but he was much more than that and was actually believed in working class struggle worldwide for all working people.
Yeah, Connolly is experiencing what many unions had to deal with in America in the 1900s and in the 20th century. Is this that you had this division between the socialists and the communists, and of course he had to deal with the other groups as well, the other radical left groups as
like
well,
the anarchists, yeah,
the anarchists. But the main thing is that a lot of unions came to a halt, and a lot of them had a lot of internal clashing because of this idea of revolutionary, take the state, powerful militant force versus socialists. Let's work through the system and try to overtake it without using violence and things mm-hmm. like that. And that, I mean, that really broke a lot of different unions. IWW, there's quite a few. AFL-CIO before it merged, mm-hmm. both groups, the AFL and the CIO, had to deal with those issues as well. Mm-hmm. So yeah, I mean that's kind of a historical trend of unions, is especially during that time when you have the Gompers, but then you have the Eugene Debs. Mm-hmm. You know, so it's just interesting to see all these different people come in and try to decide what type of tactic they're going to use to overtake the state, because they believe the state had to be restructured, but it's just what strategy and tactic. And I think that's something that we overlook when we look at how social movements are created, is that you have a bunch of different people in the room who have different strategies and tactics. And the one thing that you have an objective to that you want to mm-hmm. deal with, but the strategies usually break down the movement itself. So mm-hmm. I think that's the one thing that's always hurt working class solidarity, is the idea of a strategy. You know, some people like violence, some people don't want to use it. Mm-hmm. I mean, it's just things that we really have to start questioning if we're ever going to really come up with some type of movement against oppression.
Sure. And, you know, the issue of violence, I mean, Connolly really was opposed to violence until he went back to Ireland and was involved in the 1913 Dublin General Strike. What happened there was that the Irish police and the British military started beating workers mm-hmm. and detaining them and torturing them and stuff, trying to intimidate them, shooting some of them, you know, in the streets, of course. And they armed themselves initially with clubs, but later with pistols and rifles to defend themselves. Yep. You know, and this is what happens a lot of times. And then the victim is blamed as the aggressor, you know, so to speak, you know. And so this is, you know, what happened in Ireland. And, of course, we can see lots of other historical examples of this, you know, throughout the whole world, you know. Yeah. But anyway, okay, I want to play some more Irish music and go into another interesting figure from Ireland, a more contemporary one, a woman named Bernadette Devlin, in here in just a moment. So I played some, this is something from a contemporary Irish band called Copper Kelly. It's also political. It's called Who Will Raise Their Voice. So I'm going to play that here real quick, and then we'll be right back. You're listening to World Labor Hour on the Support Community Station, WFT in Champaign.
The sparks fly from deadlines overdue, and make no mistake now, time will hunt them down till the language of reason runs them to the ground. And who will raise their voice as the cruel winds blow? And who will call a truce? And who can break a fall? To those without a song, and who will raise their voice and carry us along? Those images are everywhere, like sand in your hair, from the beaches of childhood. Slip through your fingers, they're like years of our lives, tormenting and cruel. Will the world look this way again, silent and true? And who will raise their voice as the cruel winds blow? And take or fall. Whisper words of reason to those without a song. And who raised their voice?
Okay, that was Capper Kelly. The song was Who Will Raise Their Voice. And, you know, it's... anyway, so we're back, and I want to talk a little about the time we have left with a more contemporary Irish political activist named Bernadette Devlin. And she was born in 1947, and she was an Irish socialist and Republican. Now, Republican means a lot, something different in Europe than it does in the United States. Political activist, basically someone who believes in a parliamentary democracy. Anyway, she served as a member of the UK Parliament from 69 to 74, from Northern Ireland, and in that role at one point she slapped the Home Secretary Reginald Malding as a reaction to his comments on the Bloody Sunday shootings of unarmed nonviolent protesters. And anyway, she was studying psychology at Queen's University in Belfast in 1968 when she took a prominent role in the student-led civil rights organization People's Democracy and was subsequently excluded from the university. She was involved in the Battle of the Bogside during the period they call the Troubles, which is during the 60s and 70s. And she, after engaging on the side of the residents in the Battle of the Bogside, she was convicted of incitement to riot in December 69, which she served a short jail term for. And then after being reelected in 1970 in the general election of the parliament, Devlin declared that she would sit in parliament as an independent socialist. She was also a witness to the Bloody Sunday events. She was there when it happened. And anyway, she helped form the Irish Republican Socialist Party in 1974, which was a breakaway from the official Sinn Féin, and also was a break with the official Irish Republican Army. Anyway, she was a big supporter of the hunger strikers. She stood as an independent candidate in support of the prisoners on the blanket protest and dirty protest at Longkesh Prison in the 1979 elections, and as leading spokesperson for the Smash H Block campaign, which supported the 1981 Irish hunger strikers in 1980 and 81. Really interesting that a lot of the tactics used by the British in Northern Ireland in the 60s and 70s were used in Iraq after the invasion. And it seems, you know, it's the same old thing. And really was interesting too was that an Irish citizen came forward, was about 8 years ago, and broke a story to the Irish press, which the Guardian of London actually picked up eventually, about how he had actually worked for British intelligence for 10 years, was supposed to be an IRA member, and he actually set off bombs killing civilians that the IRA was blamed for, but it was actually the work of British intelligence. Wow. Really interesting. I guess when Bernadette Devlin was invited to come to the United States in 1969, she was invited by the Irish American community, and then of course the Irish Americans brought her here. When she landed in Brooklyn, they wanted to hear about the dirty British and how the Protestants in the North were oppressing Irish Catholics in Belfast. And Devlin, of course, was more than willing to talk about this as she visited pubs and Knights of Columbus halls from New York to San Francisco. But things got complicated when Devlin broadened her definition of injustice when she began talking about how the struggle for civil rights for African Americans in the U.S. was just as important as the fight for civil rights in Ireland. And she found herself on the receiving end of some cold, hard stares. And she ended up criticizing Irish American kingmaker Chicago Mayor Richard Daley as well for a lot of his policies. And it says that, you know, this was in response to a lot of the Irish American community becoming more conservative over time, and you know, a lot of you know, racism. Not everybody that was Irish was like that, but it was unfortunately a common trend, unfortunately. And it said that when she finally made it out to Los Angeles, she said it was a really schizophrenic crowd consisting of demure white-haired Irish Americans and hippies and radicals who'd come to see the revolutionary from Ireland. Hey, it was 1969. It was interesting. She went back to Ireland exhausted and frustrated after this American tour, and found that war-torn Northern Ireland was easier to handle than 1960s America. You know, her own words. I guess later on in 2003, in 1981, her and her husband were shot in an assassination attempt in their home. They